Welcome back to The Slow Dive, where we explore the deeper currents of impact, community, and storytelling. I am your host, Farida, and I am joined by our producer, Drew. Today, we have the incredible Elaine McMillian Sheldon, one of the most illuminating filmmakers of our time. Elaine is an Academy Award nominated, Emmy and Peabody Award winning director whose work has brought urgent, human-centered stories to the forefront of public consciousness. She's a visionary behind two acclaimed Netflix original documentaries, Heroin and Recovery Boys, both of which explore the realities of America's opioid crisis with deep compassion and clarity. Her storytelling has earned her 6 Emmy nominations and 3 Peabody nominations, and in 2024, she was inducted into the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences, a testament to her enduring impact on the documentary world. Her most recent film, King Cole, premiered at the 2023 Sundance Film Festival and continues her powerful work examining the soul of Appalachia, weaving together history, myth, and memory in unique cinematic experience. She has been named a Guggenheim Fellow, a Creative Capital Awardee, a United States Artist Fellow, and one of the Filmmaker Magazine's 25 New Faces of Independent Film. Raised in West Virginia and now based in Elkins, West Virginia, Elaine brings deep roots and radical imagination to everything she creates. It's a true privilege to have her with us today. Let's dive in. Welcome, Elaine.
It's nice to be here. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
Of course.
Well, first segment is our icebreaker segment. So I'm going to ask you, when was the last time you felt awe?
Felt awe pretty much this morning. There was a huge worm that I was digging up the garden trying to weed out around my sad little vegetables I'm trying to grow, and there was a worm that was so big it was like somewhere between a worm and a snake. It was the biggest worm I've ever seen in my life, and I picked it up and it did this thing where it like shrunk its body in half, and I was in awe. It was pretty magical.
That is magical. Mm-hmm. What are you gardening? What are you planting?
Like, I'm just trying. I just like to have an excuse that gets me outside every day. Just, you know, it's a reminder. So I'm just growing some zucchini and beans and peas and tomatoes, and we'll see if anything actually comes of it. But I attempt it every year.
I mean, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. What does home feel like if you had to describe it, or what is home?
You know, I'm like so drawn to home, but yet I've moved 9 times in 11 years, in the past 11 years, and I moved 10 times before the age of 12. So it's a really strange thing for me to be as obsessed I am with the idea of home and have been a person that's moved over 20 times in my life. I think home is not really a road or a place or something that's a pinpoint on a map as much as it is a feeling in. And it, to me, like, I pretty much can't feel home unless there are mountains and hills around me. So part of it's geography, part of it is trees, part of it is people. So like, there's just certain people, obviously family, but sometimes friends that when you're around them, it feels like home. So, you know, I've been to other countries that have had similar feelings, whether it was parts of Albania or parts of Scotland or parts of Ireland, where I've been like, this also feels like home. So it's not necessarily just Appalachia. It's not always a map, a point on a map, as much as it is a feeling that's transmitted from the place.
Beautiful. No, that resonates with me. It's a feeling. It's a point, then a point on a place. I love that. Can you share, if you have, a happy discovery story, an accidental gem, a prize, or you've discovered something by accident that was wonderful?
I feel like I'm easily, like, there's this joke about my husband's dad, who's always pointing at things to his wife and saying, look at that, Jan. Like, he's always like discovering things and pointing them out in that way. And I feel like I'm kind of like that. So I'm always delighted by random things. Gosh, I wish I'm like struggling to come up with one. One thing is that when I moved in this house in January, it's over 100 years old. It's a really old house, and it's come with a lot of things that were not so delightful, like water issues, but also the previous owner left this garden that she, not a garden to eat food, but like things that she found in the mountains over the years and has transplanted them here. So like things that grow wild, whether it's spring ephemerals, and like, I just have been so surprised. Every day I walk out, there's a new plant that I've never seen, or maybe I've only seen in the mountains. So that's been a delight. But I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm not answering this well because I'm constantly, I talk to a lot of strangers and I eavesdrop a lot. And so I'm constantly surprised by people.
Yeah.
It's an overwhelming question.
No, your answer is exactly the answer we're looking for, because these are reflective questions and we encourage our audience to think and do a deeper dive. So I love your answers. And you're right, like wildflowers and native plants, that's a nice, happy discovery.
It is.
It's very cool.
And they are definitely under threat if they're not protected. So it's nice to be able to have a couple here, and hopefully I can, when the fall comes, I can collect their seeds and replant them. We'll see.
Yes. And try. No, that's beautiful. And I wouldn't expect less. You're a documentary maker. So that's important work that you're doing. Okay, well, we're going to go into our first segment. It's documentary subject and inspiration. Of course, you've done some wonderful works, just really compelling works. But to start off, for our audience, when did you know you wanted to be a filmmaker? Was there a defining moment for you in your life?
I kind of fell into film. I just wanted to be a storyteller. I wanted to write and do photography, and that's what I studied in undergrad. I graduated during, right in and after the 2008 recession, and so there were no newsroom jobs, which was sort of my career goal, was to work at a magazine or some type of organization like that. And they were all folding, but there was one job that was popping up everywhere, which was multimedia journalism. I'm like, I don't know what this is, but clearly I need to learn this because this is the only way I'm going to be able to support myself. And so I kind of fell into filmmaking through that, because I had to expand my skills beyond just writing and photography to be able to survive in the marketplace. And then I really fell in love with film because it comes to life. It uses all the senses that we have and allowed me new levels of creativity. It gave me an excuse to hang around people longer, to like find moments. And it really always kind of felt like a scavenger hunt. And then in the process of making the film, like editing of the film, becomes a new discovery of the material. So I didn't know I wanted to be a filmmaker. I didn't grow up around filmmakers. I grew up in a really small place. I saw journalists and that was like, I want to do that. I want to tell stories. And so if it wasn't for economic recession, I may not be a filmmaker. I would have been just as happy writing and doing photography, I think. But who knows?
What was your, no, that's a happy accident too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was like one of your first projects as a director or like multimedia that you could share with our audience?
Well, right out of college, I worked in the documentary video department at the Washington Post. And one story I did there was about young people leaving their corporate tech jobs that were paying a ton and going back to small farms in Loudoun County, Virginia. And I think it's an interesting film because it's done in a pretty journalistic way, that not necessarily how I make films now, but it's very, you can see sort of like threads of stuff I'm doing today that's still in that film. People searching for meaning, searching for identity, searching for belonging, a relationship with land, a question about the future, like this anxiety of the future. I think there's themes in that film that I made for the Washington Post. I think it was called Farming Young, that I still feel in my work today, and I still seek to answer in my work today. It's like people on the edge of transition, whether that's economic or culture or whatever it might be. So yeah, that was an early, probably 2009 when I made that.
Do you feel like that shift is happening now as well? Since like that was over a decade ago. Like, do you think people are gravitating?
I think so. I just think that the tech machine is so big now, it's so much more pervasive in our lives. And like, even if you escape the job, there's no escaping the tethers that I think those people were trying to escape behind. Like, I think I didn't get a smart or an iPhone or any real legitimate phone until 2013. Like, I just had some little flip phone thing. So like, I was making films in an era where people weren't documenting themselves. When I started making films, they weren't documenting themselves. And also we weren't also tied to tech. So like, yeah, it's new in the sense of like how pervasive tech is in our lives. And like those people, I think, have made a bunch of money in tech and now we're going back to the land and blah, blah, blah. But it's different in that tech feels, it used to feel like very clearly urban rural divide, like haves and have nots. And now you see this like bleeding in of technology in rural spaces through data centers and other things. And it doesn't feel all that different than the way like coal mines open in rural places and mostly benefit other places. So like, it's a different story, but it's the same story. It's like all recycled.
Yeah. No, I see that. And getting back to like your first story, or the one that you discovered in 2009, do you see like how that was the beginning of like your overall like stories you're telling now through your films? Like even then, like was there a voice emerging or your style emerging that you recognize now?
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely, from the sense that I want to make films that show life happening. So that film was my attempt. You know, I was coming out of journalism, and all journalism really taught me, which is very powerful, is like how to find people and how to ask them questions. Very powerful tools. But the films I was drawn to, and I don't really know why, because it's not as if I was a film buff and watching a lot of films, but the films I was drawn to making weren't people talking in a chair at me. They were seeing whatever they were struggling with actually unfold in real time. And so I think that that film, while I had made other films before that film was my first attempt at like, I'm going to spend days just sort of trying to be a fly on the wall, which we know is impossible. But as much as I tried, that was the point, right? So I see that as like a first attempt of verite filmmaking, which is something that I still hold in very high regard today. And I think it's more difficult to do today than it was back then, because I think there's just a general, there's more of a general skepticism around the presence of a camera today than there was in 2009.
Is it because there's more cameras now and everyone's like self-documenting?
There's more cameras. I think people feel exploited by media in a number of different ways, suspicious of media. They also tell their own stories, and they don't really need documentary filmmakers the way, I mean, it used to be when you walked into like a community meeting or a town or anything, people were like, you're either the news or like, what channel is this going to be on? That's what I would always hear. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But now like news, local news has shrunk so much. They don't often show up with gear, right? They'll send like one person with a notepad. And so you're kind of the only person. It's just not as friendly. I can't explain it. And it's not just here in West Virginia. It's all over. I think it's partly like the oversaturation of images. I think people also feel like a sense of privacy that has been invaded that they didn't necessarily feel protective of in 2009. It's a lot of things. I mean, think about the number of stories we openly give up to the world daily on social media and then start thinking, yeah. So it's just the whole ecosystem has changed.
I think you made such an important point right there. Like there's all these like tributaries that lead to this big ocean of storytelling right now, and that it is saturated. And also like before there was more citizen engaged journalism. And now everybody kind of misconstrues, at least in my opinion, sometimes social media as being citizen journalism, which, you know, has its biases too, because we're not using the journalistic framework. So that could be. But that's fascinating. You're right. How do you tell those stories now? Because if you said your thesis statement is you like to see, like your philosophy or your thesis as far as your overall work is to see life happening, right? Is that what you said? And documenting that. So if people are documenting their own stories, that's a unique question. Like, how do you tell those stories?
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm starting a project now where we're trying to ask those questions of, I mean, it sounds a little dramatic, but it's like, how do you make a documentary in a post-documentary world? And what I mean by that is like, we're living in an era that I don't think is unlike other historical eras that I personally didn't live through, but other parts of history where the breakdown of trust has occurred, facts are disputed. And people don't really need or want you to tell their story always. And so how do you then work with a community to co-curate the story? Mm. Like, how do you get them engaged in a way that there is a reason for them to be involved? Because I think a lot of people feel, you know, documentaries used to be seen as this educational, good-meaning thing. But it's now documentary, every streamer Most of them are true crime. Most of them don't have any intentions anymore. Like, documentaries are not a one-size-fits-all thing. When you say a documentary now, it doesn't mean the same thing to everyone. And sometimes that's a dirty word. Like, documentary is like something they don't want to be a part of. It sounds like an expose. And so rather than being like, I'm the documentary filmmaker, the anthropological perspective, I'm going to come and just watch you, ignore me, right? Like, rather than like pretending that's even a possibility, why not ask people what parts of their life do they want to share? Like, why not sort of co-curating that? And I think there's been a little bit of like deception of documentary filmmakers who think, you know, they have some form of objectivity to they should have the gaze to look on someone's life because they can see it in a way that person doesn't. But I just don't think that'll fly anymore. I don't think we can work like that anymore. I think we have to be more respectful and think of it as a collaboration. So I'm trying to figure out what that means.
Yeah.
There's a lot at play. Like, do you pay them? Do you pay for their feet? Like, you know, and then are they performers? And then is there a problem with that? So there's a lot of questions there to bring up. But I think they're all important questions.
No, absolutely. And what you just said, collaboration and co-curator, I think is the piece that people become participants in documentary as well. And then, but what you were saying about documentary being a bad word, I think at least docutainment, like more salacious, character-driven docuseries have become more entertaining, more expose style. So yeah, they've all kind of like muddied the genre, but it's still, I mean, I see where it could be like that. And, but your works are not like that at all.
Yeah,
your works are beautiful and they go in deep and you really bring a lot of compassion, a compassionate framework to really share those stories, especially in King Cole. So I see that through line, what you're talking about. Like, you want to be a fly in the wall, you want to co-curate, you want to collaborate, you want to be responsible. In your works, it's beautiful. How do you, is there like a day-to-day basis, like, when you're ideating, or how do you source your ideas? Or is there something like, is there a process for future documentary filmmakers or filmmakers that you could share that works for you for all these amazing pieces that you've done, especially Recovery Boys and Heroin? And
yeah, it's funny. I think about how I used to source ideas versus how I source ideas now. And it's pretty boring now. Whereas before, it used to be like, I had to go out in the world, right? Or I had to find someone I already knew and ask them. So like how I found the Farming Young story is I just like went to the farmer's market and started asking people, what do you do? Like, on like struck up a conversation and found the person, right? Now you would probably like search, you'd use a search engine, right? Like you would search young people working in agriculture, and then you would make a bunch of phone calls and try to find the person. Like, it's not as fun and creative of a way always to find stories, because we do rely on the internet and we do rely on sort of this distance between us. So I try to do that. Like, obviously, I'm looking for a town that has a specific type of story around like nuclear energy. And so it's like, I'm looking for a town that is, that has like either one is opening or one is closing. And so like certain keyword might bring me to certain types of, sometimes I'm digging through state documents where I'm looking for towns, sometimes digging through headlines where it's like, oh, this town has bubbled up. Let's call the mayor. Let's see who's involved. And like, it just becomes sort of a chain of events. And then if I'm working on something that's within my own parameter, like places I can travel to easily, sometimes, like, you know, the way we found the Women for Heroin was, you just rolled up to Huntington one day. We were just like, let's go talk to the mayor. And the mayor is always a good person to start with, not because you plan to make a film about them, but because they know everyone in town. And we were talking to the mayor's like council and drug control policy or whatever it was. And they called Jan Rader, who's the fire chief, who ended up being the main person of our film. And like, we probably would have eventually found her because it's a small town and you know, but the fact that this person called them. So like being in person is also one of the best ways to find stories. Like, I think there's a lot of filmmakers that are having to tell stories that are really far from where they are. And so that doesn't, they are just using the internet to source, and they are just making a bunch of phone calls. And you can only get so far before you have to get in the place and do the groundwork and meeting people and have coffee with them and like not filming and just meeting them. So a lot of the stuff is spontaneous. A lot of it's following the news, local, very local news, hyper local news. A lot of it's talking to people, just like, who do you know that cares about this? So it really spans like sort of the very sterile right search terms all the way down to like going to the hardware store and asking someone a question. So, and finding the right person.
Those are great tips. And I love hearing about your process because it is so different. And there's so many different ways to get that. Some people start with like, I want to make a movie about this. I want to film this, a documentary about this. And then they kind of reverse engineer and go out and find the subjects. And then what you're saying, like start local. There's stories within your community. What do you feel like is the, and this is just an opinion, I just would love to know, because a lot of your stories are so like community centered, if not all of them. But what do you think is importance of our, the importance or the value of archiving community stories as far as historically?
Yeah.
Can you speak to that?
I think it isn't the Agnes Varda quote who she said, you know, I film regular people, like not people in charge, not to give them power or dignity or anything like that, but to, and, or to give them voice. That's like always a thing people say, like give the voiceless a voice. It's like people have a voice. They don't need you for that. You could amplify their voice, but you're not giving them a voice. But she was something like, you know, to allow them to imagine their life or like a mirror to see their life. And I think that that's really important. If you're making films in communities, yes, you're making it for an audience outside that community, but you should be making it in a way that the community sees themselves. And that does not mean you're not challenging them. Certainly there are very challenging parts of my film, but you are holding their hand in that challenge. You are being, you know, a loving community member. Like you're, if you're speaking hard truths, you're following those up with something that's encouraging, right? Like just like constantly that the sort of documentary technique of just like barraging us with bad information and painting certain communities in certain ways of looking different, disenfranchised and whatever. It's just like, it just got to go. Like we can't have that type of media anymore because it does create this hostility that I'm talking about that I'm mm-hmm. up against in communities. So yeah, community is at the root of everything, but community is a very complicated thing. So the version of the community I see and get to experience is only one person's experience, right? So it's tricky because I make films in a region that not a lot of films come out of Appalachia. And many of them that do are done by sort of drop-in parachute journalism. And they have their script before they come in, right? They want to get the like dirty couch in the front yard that was discarded. They want to get the trailer park. They want to get the barefoot kid. Mm. Like all those things are here, like they are anywhere. But if you were to just come in with that script, that's all you're going to see. And I just try not to do that. I tried. It's not even really, even when I go to other places, I think it makes me more sensitive to not doing that because I don't mm-hmm. just make films here in my town and region. I think I'm pretty sensitive to the fact that I can see that low hanging fruit and I intentionally mm-hmm. don't shoot it because I don't even want the editor to be tempted by it. You know, unless there's a reason, you just shouldn't use shorthand to mm-hmm. describe a group of people or community of people because the community of people is a set of people with diverse opinions and lives. They're not as easily categorized as we like to think.
No, important point. Yeah, you want to broaden your lens and the scope and show the different communities within the communities and not reinforce mm-hmm. any negative tropes or just isolate one story or stereotype. And yeah, those are very important points you brought up that I think to bring that sensitivity as a filmmaker. And I think also to show an holistic lens to filmmaking as well, right? Like it's not just like short-sighted, like you said, shorthand. Moving on to our second segment on mental health and addiction, and we're also going to cover community sensitivity to that. It is May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and two of your films tackle addiction in a very compassionate ways. Heroin and Recovery Boys. How did you prepare to make these films with your subjects? And how was it received or in the process when you were taking the stories? Like, could you share with us that mm-hmm. process? They're very compelling.
Yeah, they were made pretty differently. Recovery Boys, we made over 2 years and we filmed primarily with 4 people, but we did not know who those people were going into the film. All we had was access to a rehab that was to open its doors. We did not know who was going to be the first to come, and we didn't know if they would even agree to be part of a film. So we were kind of taking a gamble, and we just thought it was interesting that this rehab was being started by a father who's also a doctor who whose own son has struggled with substance use disorder. So that was an interesting personal hook, but it also was a farming-based rehab, which was like something I'd never heard of and thought, wow, that's really visual. It's in this really cool little mountain town. Like certainly something interesting will occur, right? Mm-hmm. So we basically just kind of rolled with what came. So as each person came, they had to, you know, some of them we'd talk on the phone with while they were in jail, whether they're being released to come there, and others we didn't get to meet until they rolled up that moment at the rehab and we had to talk to them. And that conversation was, because we had no funding in the beginning and we didn't know where it was going, it ended up being a Netflix film, but no funding, right? The way we made that film was we lived about 45 minutes away and we just would go on days we weren't doing other work. And so that usually was like 2 or 3 days a week. And they were in the rehab for 6 months. So we did that for 6 months and then they were out. We filmed them for 9 months after that. Wait, no, 12 months. I can't remember. 2 years total. So you do the math. So that process was pretty vulnerable for both of us. Like, we didn't know each other. We had to get to know each other very quickly. Some guys were like, yeah, like, you could phone me, but I don't want to be interviewed. Or some guys were like, wait until I detox. Like, don't be around me until I'm ready to, like, actually move through this world more clearly. And some people were like, I don't mind to be filmed in groups, but I don't want to be spoken to individually on camera. And some guys were like, you can film my whole life. Like, I have nothing to hide. And I would like sort of to be on this journey because I think it's an interesting parallel journey with my recovery. So they all had very different levels of comfortability, and we just respected those and continued to negotiate those after they got out of rehab. Some of them were hard to find. We were having to track them down, and it was like, what do we do? Do we continue to keep trying to call and knock on the door if they don't want to see us? And we got really lucky that 4 men really did want to see us over those 2 years and kept opening the doors, even if it was challenging. And heroin was different because we were kind of thrust into the fire in the sense that we were embedded with the fire department and the drug court and NSHA, who is coming across people that we could never call in advance or clear in advance. And so that was a tough one because we always told people our main focus was these 3 women across different sectors of private and public. But whoever they touch was the people that we then had to get access to and build trust with on a really quick basis. Sometimes we'd only see them once, whether they were a victim of an overdose or whatever it was. And then that meant filming everything and then talking to them afterwards about what we filmed. And some of them saying, delete that, right? Like, you can't use that in your film. And us having to be like, okay, like, we can't use that, right? Because we couldn't get their permission before. And so we just had to keep filming and filming until we were able to meet enough people that, I mean, I think largely anyone that participated in heroin did because they appreciated what these women were doing in their lives, not because they wanted to be part of the film or we really did anything. The real trust was built by these women who trusted us. And that is kind of everything. And that's why these women are spectacular and should be considered producers of the film, is because they, without them, a film like that can't exist. They are vouching for a documentary crew, which nobody has any reason to let into their life. It's a very different ways of approaching community and building trust and trying to be responsible in both.
How was, after the films, both of those films, how was it received by your participants in the film after they saw it?
I mean, amazing, really. I mean, not hard. Like, families that are in both of them, you know, they're hard films to watch, both of them. But I mean, we just had everyone's support. We didn't pull any punches. Nobody was surprised by anything. There wasn't anything in the film that people felt tricked by, like, oh, you use this in this way, and we just didn't do those things, and they kind of knew what was going to be in there. I mean, it helps to choose people who, you know, speaking to the mental health perspective, like, it's really challenging documenting people in recovery who, you know, relapse as part of recovery and having so many ups and downs in their life. And it was really concerning to us to show the film to the guys after some of them had already relapsed. And what was it going to be like for them to see a high point and a low point? Like, you know, Adam, who's in the film, where you see his graduation, he's doing so well. And then you also see him back in a low point, back in a high point. But you know, for all of them, it was an emotional roller coaster, but all of them were thankful. And, you know, it's not as easy to be like, they all loved it and everything was great, but we didn't have any complaints, and people felt like we told the truth. And as much as possible, we were trying to bring them to screening so they could just speak on behalf of the film. So it wasn't just us. You know, Jan and Nisha are still doing tours with the film. Like, there was a group in Florida recently who emailed me wanting to bring them both to speak and show the film. So, like, they still work as advocates on the film way more than we filmmakers have ever been asked to, which has been great because they're the ones, like, there's a lot of attention on the film and the filmmakers when you make a film. But I do think that is part of one of the co-creating things too, is like, if you have people in your film that are working on the ground on this issue, they should be the ones that are sitting next to you or in place of you on, you know, in press circuits. And that's not often the way it's done. Yeah.
No, that is the impact of the film being like a impact tool and a community tool to continue the talk and raising awareness for recovery, which I think, because they're sensitive topics, and you approached your subjects and participants with such a compassionate thing, I think it lends to the story. It shows how I think it's really important to destigmatize addiction. It is a mental health issue, and so many people are being criminalized for that, where in line there's a trauma behind it. So I think the way you quote those films are very important, in the sense that you're offering solutions. And if you still have impact screenings and you're advocating it using this film, I think it's a beautiful piece of work. And I know I've done a few smaller projects, not a documentary, with opioid, the recovery movement and that. And one of the things I've learned from the recovery community and how gracious they are sharing their highs and lows is that speaking about it is very healing. You know, mm-hmm. Sharing their story is very healing. And I think that mm-hmm. lessens the pain, the stigma that we would see, because it's not just in certain areas. It's like it's a situation that it's affecting all communities of all sizes, all economic, whether you know about it or not. And most of people, unfortunately, that fall into a certain economic group is criminalized because there's no resources. So I do think these are very important stories, I think, as the subjects, and they're healing. I know that because sharing the recovery movement and sharing the other side of the issue and continue to talk about it, it's a healing process, I think. And from what I've mm-hmm. learned from the recovery movement. So I think how you prepared for those films with that sensitivity was great. What advice would you give to new filmmakers regarding intentional practices in documentary filmmaking, if there was a few that you would mm-hmm. highlight from your practice?
Yeah, I think a couple things. I think I would not rush the story. I think that from an intentional point of view of not thinking of a delivery date that's based on some career goal of yours, but actually base a timeline of a film on what a story needs and what a community needs and what can actually be valuable and useful to that community. It may not be very valuable. Your documentary may not be very valuable to the community if you can only spend 2 days, right? And like really thinking about how your project can serve the community and the existing structures that need supported. And so, you know, we shot Heroin. We would have been done with that film if it was just sort of a short that we were making. But mm-hmm. we were making it in tandem with Recovery Boys, kind of thinking like maybe they'll both be features. I don't know. And so we filmed over a year and a half for the film Heroin, but it ended up being a short. And that was because it felt like we needed that much time. Like we would see, it's not ideal, like, you know, like people like to be finished before that amount of time, but if it was what the story needed, it needed to see those arcs like sort of come through and also have the ending where it's like, okay, and now it's repeating itself again, like nothing ends. It's all recycled. So my first piece of advice is slow down and stop trying to put, it's a very like Hollywood model of being like, we're going to shoot this many mm-hmm. days for this many edits. And it's just like, is that what the story needs? Is that what the community needs? Because really that should be your question, not when the next film festival deadline is, because that's just offensive to the community story that you're taking. And then the second thing I would say is work on cultivating that community as a future cheerleader and audience of that film that can then share it with others. The people that you are documenting are not just subjects that you're studying, they are participants mm. in the full making of the film and the distribution of the film. And you need to be thinking about how to care to make sure that when that film comes out, it is being used in certain communities. I mean, we did a 50 screen release of King Cole, which was in theaters, and 50 screens, like 50 theaters across the Southeast and Appalachia. And it's like, that would have been impossible had I not had over a decade of work in this region, that when I was reaching out to the theaters, we could sort of say, like, we're also partnering with this nonprofit in your county that's going to help get mm-hmm. people to buy tickets, right? So like creating actual relationships with people, not just people you're filming, but the community that surrounds them, so that when your film is finished, it's not just put on the internet and no one watches it, or it's not just put in a film festival and then goes nowhere, but you actually create a community that needs it. And I think that requires you to slow down again. My biggest piece of advice is to slow down, like stop rushing the process, find stories that you can return to, find stories that surprise you, and be respectful when people need space. That's like a huge thing. I see a lot of greed in documentary filmmaking of just one more scene or one more thing. And people wear their participants out and they don't want to deal with that. I wouldn't either if I were them.
Mm-hmm.
So being grateful of what they let you in on and using it wisely. There's so many things like,
these are such resourceful and wonderful, insightful tips, because you're right. You have to build your audience and your ecosystem by, it's very grassroots as well. Like, you know, if you're going to go out to your community to tell stories from the community, they should know you as well. So it doesn't, and I'm so it doesn't feel, like you said, maybe greedy or extractive, but working with the community, right? Like in collaboration. So I really love that, because it's true. Like, you know, what's the point of making a film about the community and then you can't share it with them and it can't benefit them, right? It feels only extractive. So like what you're saying, return back to the story, return back to the land. I love that. I love that. And it's a very beautiful framework that you've employed.
But often, I just want to say, often it's the they're the last people thought of, like the people that are in the film. Most filmmakers are making films to hope to get into a film festival or to sell to a distributor. And I understand the economics of that. But I just think like it's no longer your golden ticket to get picked up by a streamer. You're not going to even know. They're not even going to share with you who's watching that film. So if you want a sustainable career as a storyteller, if you want to be able to do this over and over, this is something I'm having to learn too. It's like, I need to know who's watching my films. And I need to know how to support them in sharing it with other people and how to make it available. So yeah, I think about sort of the energy grid, like in America, how like everyone's just making energy. All states are making energy to go to this centralized grid, and then it's divvied out. And it's like, that's kind of how media and documentary and storytelling is, when it really, we should be on our own little systems, right? And it's like regional filmmaking should have a revival. You know, there should be a channel in which regional filmmakers, which now is seen as like a lower form of filmmaking, like, you know, it's like you're either like international or American wide. But like there was a time, like regional writers especially were like the hottest thing in literature. I think there could be an ecosystem, a film ecosystem that's more equitable for filmmakers and participants, that builds an audience in a way that is, serves communities and serves filmmakers. It's just, I think it's like taking the breaking down of this big media conglomerate, which we're currently seeing, like it being not buying as much, like blah, blah, blah. And now filmmakers are like, right, that's not the end goal, to sell your film, because there's still so many questions after that.
Yeah. And even if someone was to go in that direction to sell the film, at the heart of the story, I feel like even in storytelling, you need to give yourself time for the story to emerge and to develop. It can't be a rush job, right? So out of all your films, Elaine, what was the one film that changed you forever, or was the most challenging or emotionally exhausting, or one that just changed you forever after making that film?
I think Heroin, Recovery Boys, and Tottweiler were all emotionally, like, I couldn't do any more films on the opioid crisis after those films. I just felt so overwhelmed. It's just such a heavy topic to look at a lot of time. And it really makes you admire the people that work in those fields, because they're not filmmakers. They don't get to just dip in and see it for 4 years and go away. Like, this is their life work, whether they're counselors or in EMS services or whatever. And that just makes me respect them so much more. But the film that I think changed me, didn't just emotionally exhaust me, but actually emotionally changed me, was probably King Cole, because it required me to do things I had never done before. So it required a level of growth that I was uncomfortable with. It also required me to write narration and narrate the film. So I'm also the narrator. And it required rethinking my traditional ideas of the documentary and playing with new ways of telling stories and truly making a film where I'm letting the film guide us on what decisions to make. Like, what does this film want? This thing is like growing and becoming its own living being, basically. So like, what does it want? Because it's not wanting to be just an observational film. It's needing, it's wanting us to say things and wanting us to show things that we can't just do in a traditional verite way. So that film changed me, because I don't know if I can ever go make another film like I have in the past after making King Cole, because it was so creatively stimulating that like a film like maybe Heroin and Recovery Boys, which are very gratifying films to make, they weren't as creatively stimulating. It was more of like you sit your butt down with a camera and you show up day after day. I mean, it was just like, it's like manual labor basically, whereas like King Cole was a lot of the mind, and it was using parts of creativity that I hadn't been able to before in those films because they weren't my story.
Very poetic visually and beautiful, and I see a lot of that in your wonderful newsletter too, Elaine, which I subscribe to, and I love. No, it's a great, I will tell the audience, it's, the name is what, In Between Frames, right? Between Frames. Excellent newsletter. I love the style is very poetic, but it's very true to your visual style too. So I get that. And I love seeing that, how directors and filmmakers, like their auteur, their styles, it shows in everything that they do and with more films. So I love your newsletter. And I think I glean a lot of insight from it, just the way you share how you tell your stories. And I do see that community-centered approach. That is truly what you're doing. And that's why you're able to capture such amazing stories for us. Is in the future, are there any subjects or not subjects, any documentaries you'd like to produce more of that are a little bit different, aside from the nuclear one that you're looking at to develop right now?
I am not very topic driven, or like there are certain topics that really interest me. I'm constantly reading, whether it's weird histories or what, there are certain things I'm drawn to, certain, like definitely. But I think I'm more, and I learned this after King Cole, I think I'm more process oriented in the sense of I kind of cycle through things quicker than I think I would have realized. I've only been doing my career really since 2009, but really, really since 2013 feels like when it really began, like I became independent. I was like, okay, I'm doing this, started my company, blah, blah, blah. And like from 2013 to 2025, I have gone through such major mental shifts about how I want to spend my time, not just as a filmmaker, but as a human. And that affects the films. And so I think, you know, I also make films with my partner, my husband, who is a cinematographer. Yeah. And so I think we're thinking a lot more today than we were back then about how your filmmaking isn't separate from your life, but is part of your life. Because I think that previously was how my life worked, was this was my film work, and often it was very heavy, but my life was like a way of escaping that. And now that we have children and we live in this small community, we're sort of like, how do we actually make film more a part of a thread that's like also tied with raising kids and also tied with a garden and a community and all these things? Because it's even as sensitive as we are as filmmakers, which I really think we are, that can also be extractive to your own life, right? Like you are spending your time documenting other people's holidays or other people's lives, and then you kind of turn it off. And when you turn your life back on, you barely can engage with other people because you've emotionally exhausted yourself with other people. I just don't want to work like that anymore. So when I think about the future and what stories I want to tell, I'm trying to think of films and stories that feed me, not just like to get an award or to do any like tick a box of a topic, but ones that are actually, that educate me how to be a better person, how to function better in my community, how to support other people, young filmmakers, whatever it is. And there's certainly like, you know, there's films all across the world I would like to make, other countries and other cultures, and that I feel a great kinship to the stories I've done here in West Virginia and then across the South. but I only want to take on films that provide an experience that I think is more, that isn't like this sort of like false work-life balance, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
That I can like slowly turn on.
No, because there is a fatigue that comes from being like that secondhand compassion fatigue, or you're a container for other people's stories and you need a place. Yes. I love how you put that together. Last question. What is the future of documentary filmmaking from where we are right now? Is there any predictions or insights or understanding of where we are? Because I know right now, overall in the entertainment landscape, fiction and nonfiction, it's quite disruptive and we're all trying to find our footing. But specifically the future of documentaries, what are your thoughts?
I think like the very entertaining, you know, whether they're celebrity portraits or all that stuff will continue because it makes people money, and anything that makes people money is going to continue. I think you're going to see doc films overall just continue to get shorter. So those are these like micro shorts that are either released over different platforms, whether it's YouTube or TikTok or what. Like, I think that sector will grow among a younger generation. I hope that there's a nonfiction revival, as I mentioned, sort of like regional spaces. You know, I've thought about how do we make films that feel sort of like a quarterly magazine? Like, what if you had a subscription base of films that you could make every quarter, and certain people, you know, subscribed, which meant they help you actually make it. And then you have some type of opening where people are invited. And I personally am interested in exploring films that provide an in-person experience. I'm not so interested in just putting my films on the internet anymore, because there are so many films on the internet. Who's watching all of that? They can't, right? And so I'm hoping for a future where it's sort of anti what everybody else is saying about sort of like technology being able to, I don't know, like let us see everything at once, but like a small room of people over and over, because I've seen the power of that. I've seen that people actually still want that experience. And a lot of people on the right will say theaters are dying, but I sort of chalk that up to the lack of imagination of theaters. You know, you have to provide some type of experience beyond just a movie on a screen, because sometimes people's screens at home are just as nice. Like, people have wild, you know, setups at home. And so like, how do we create experiences?
Yeah,
that and are that goes, in person.
No, and I love that you said that, because yes, people do say that, you know, no one's going to the movies, but you're right. There should be a more concentrated effort to keep people going to the movies or the theaters and have community screenings and experiences, because especially about films about the community. I mean, it goes back to, once again, community is a huge aspect of documentary filmmaking, but then it's for the community and then staying connected through the stories. And I like your idea of a revival. I think hopefully our audience will hear this and people can take some insight from that and put that into their own hometowns, because you're right. There's some amazing, beautiful Art Deco theaters in my hometown that no one goes to anymore. And I'm like, do something with that. Mm-hmm. Need a place to go and congregate and discuss and connect with each other. So why not make that experience happen? So I love that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Elaine. We have one more question before we end our interview, because it's been such an insightful interview with you. Just learned so much. Mm-hmm. How can we be better community members overall, in general?
Stop trying to save the world and look at what's around you. Like, be very clear-eyed with how you can be present for the people around you. And stop caring if your actions have a thank you on the other end. You know, I think that like stops a lot of people from wanting to take positive change as a community member if they aren't told thanks or have some pat on the back. And I think that's where we kind of are. And that's why a lot of volunteer groups are dwindling the way they are, is people, I don't know where that comes from, but people stopped wanting to do things and not caring about the end result, because we can't have control, right? All we can do is control what we do to help the situation, whatever that situation is. But there became this discouragement. And so I think the best way to be a good community member is to let go of an outcome and show up And listen more than talk.
Thank you so much, Elaine. We are so honored to have you here today. And
thanks for
it was
having
a wonderful
me.
Experience. And I hope everyone goes out to see your films. They're on Netflix, they're on Amazon, on Apple TV. We're going to be linking everything in our full episode guide for all your films, for your website, your wonderful newsletter, which I just think. And also, you also do like classes, right? Or are you, or do you have?
I used to teach. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Well, I know we can stay connected with your newsletter, but thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasant experience and hope to see more of your films in the future because they're so illuminating and heartfelt. Thank you
for having me and thanks for your questions. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Slow Dive. Please be sure to subscribe and give us a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. The Slow Dive is hosted by Farida Rafiq and edited by Drew Franzblau. Our theme music is Dive by Ciro.